How would the military in Sudan deal with the unrest? The resignation of the Prime Minister and growing public anger have thrown the country further into uncertainty. Could a new power-sharing deal be the way out? This is Inside Story. Hello, welcome to the programme. I'm Kim Vanel. Sudan is again in political turmoil following the resignation of Prime Minister Abdallah Hamdok. It's come less than 2 months after he was reinstated under a deal with the military. The senior military leader, General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, is calling for an urgent caretaker government and new measures to deal with the demonstrations. Pro-democracy groups say the military should stay out of government and they're planning more protests. A political deadlock between all sides has left the country unable to transition from dictatorship to democracy since the ousting of longtime ruler Omar al-Bashir back in 2019. During a speech on state TV, Hamdok said more talks were needed for all parties to reach agreement.
We needed a round table for the salvation of the country to come to an agreement. I tried to spare my country the disaster. Recently, I met with all the civilian and military officials of the Transitional Council to address these issues. After, I decided to return to you what you have entrusted me and resign the position of Prime Minister.
Well, let's take a look back at how this started. 3 years ago, an uprising in Sudan forced the government from office. It began in December 2018 with protests over the rising cost of living. But it soon evolved into calls for an end to President Omar al-Bashir's 30-year rule. That led to him being overthrown by the military in April of 2019. A power-sharing agreement was signed in August that year. Abdallah Hamdok was appointed prime minister, leading a transitional council. In February, he announced a cabinet reshuffle in the face of major street protests against fuel and bread shortages. Then, last October, the military declared a state of emergency, dissolving the interim government and arresting civilian leaders. Since then, thousands of people have demonstrated and dozens have been killed by security forces. All right, it's time to bring in our guests. In Nairobi, Khulud Khir is a political commentator and managing partner at Insight Strategy Partners. In Somerville, Alex Deval is executive director at World Peace Foundation at Tufts University. And in Doha, we have Ahmed El-Jaili, a lawyer and legal commentator. A very warm welcome to the programme to you all. I'd like to begin with you, Ahmed El-Jaili, here in Doha. Is Abdallah Hamdok's resignation any surprise to you?
It is not. And despite all the headlines, I would describe it as probably the most consequential, irrelevant event in Sudanese history. It is irrelevant because Hamdok, as far as the people on the street are concerned, really lost his political relevance the minute he went rogue and signed that agreement with Burhan on November 21st. It is irrelevant also because it's been weeks in the making, so it's not a surprise to anyone. Yet at the same time, this could prove to be a fairly consequential event, mainly for the international community, which was content to move on from Sudan after the November 21st agreement, and maybe for the few remaining skeptics in Sudan, because what this resignation does is that it removes the last remaining fig leaf from the October 25th coup, and it shows it for what it really is. It's a full-fledged military regime now, and that in effect forces the international community to re-engage and refocus in Sudan, which might be a good thing for the impasse that is happening. And as far as the pro-democracy movement, although they have moved on beyond Hamdok and his agreement, I think the political vacuum that his departure creates does create an impetus for them to move faster, to try to present an alternative, to try to unify their front and prove to the world and to the rest of the Sudanese population that they are able to unite and present a credible alternative. So that's why it is simultaneously relevant and irrelevant at the same time.
We'll talk a little bit later about the potential role of the international community going forward, but I'd like to cross over to Nairobi. Khulud Khir, where does this leave Sudan? Where does this leave the protest movement? Where does this leave the military junta and its plans?
Well, as Ahmed pointed out, you know, Hamdok is just a sort of his tenure represents a phase in the revolution. This is not in any way the sum total of the revolution. The pro-democracy movement was there before Hamdok. It will remain there after his resignation. And so this is just now sort of entering a new phase of the revolution, one where the pro-democracy movement is unencumbered by discussions around whether Hamdok should be given a chance to make good on the promises or whether he shouldn't. You know, that conversation is now moot. The bigger conversation, the much more important conversation, is how do we ensure that the army goes back into the barracks and leaves political and economic life for good. And of course, on the military side, they now have to contend with a sort of a new calculation, both internationally but also domestically. The more they double down, and they have been doing so, the more they become sort of the clear overarching enemy without anyone to be able to sort of put the burden on. You know, Hamdok is no longer there to blame as part of the governance structure. They are the government, unequivocally. And what that means is that their international backers, mostly in the region, will be increasingly unable to support them in the same way because of the reputational risk that arises from the level of repression that we're seeing.
Alex Duval, why did Abdullah Hamdok accept this deal in November in the first place? Was it just because he was, I mean, he was under house arrest, right? But did he truly believe it would work? Was it ever going to work?
It was always going to be an extremely long shot. And I think he was under extreme duress. He was very isolated. And the key failing was that he negotiated really on his own. He didn't bring in the full democracy movement or the civilian parties. So he was isolated from the beginning. I think he had two clear motivations. One, which was, and both were honourable. One was to see if he could prevent further bloodshed, and that didn't work out because the democracy movement did not accept his compromise proposals. And the second was he sees very clearly, and perhaps more clearly than anybody else, the economic precipice over which Sudan is going. And he really hoped that he would be able to engineer enough of an economic bailout to prevent the worst from happening. Now, he never had the political base, the political support, in order to be able to leverage concessions out of the military, the concessions that would have been necessary for his position to be workable. And over the weeks, it became clearly unworkable. And if there was a surprise, the only surprise was really that he held on for as long as he did before he quit.
Okay. Ahmed El-Jaili, I mean, the deal was that was announced last month was going to be an independent technocratic cabinet under military oversight. I mean, was that ever going to be acceptable to the people?
Absolutely not. And I think that is demonstrated by the continued demonstrations on the streets. A very cursory reading of that document of November 21st will tell you that it was just creating a civilian facade for military rule. Every paragraph was echoing the statement that Burhan made on the day of the coup, and he was given increased powers. If I recall correctly, Article 4 of that agreement gave the Sovereignty Council full oversight over all executive functions. So Hamdok's hands would have been very tied. Even if he wanted to do good, he wouldn't have been able to do. And I think he realized that, albeit a bit late, but he ultimately did.
Khulod Khair, some critics of Hamdok have suggested that this not only lifts the veil on the November Pact, but shows that even over the past 2 years, since the toppling of Omar al-Bashir, that there was never actually the real political will to make a full transition to democracy. What's your take?
I think that's fairly accurate on the military side. I think they have been shown to be, you know, bad faith actors when it comes to a lot of these agreements that they signed, including the Constitutional Declaration of 2019. One of the reasons is, of course, that the Constitutional Declaration itself contained a coup clause that allowed them this sort of out in order to be able to take over if they felt that things were not going according to plan. Of course, that's a very ambiguous statement, and it gives them that sort of latitude that they've been enjoying pretty much since 2019. Some people have commented that, you know, this is sort of the military buying time, that they've been buying time over the past 2 years. And now we're really seeing this reconsolidation of the Islamo-military project that we had under Bashir. And we see this through, you know, the sort of appointments to the security sector, appointments to the legal sector, as well as the new emboldening powers of the security services, as well as the other myriad security sort of advantageous policies towards the security sector. But what that means is that effectively, you know, the past 2 years have been this sort of experiment for the military to see to what extent they could use the civilians as this fig leaf. And that didn't work so well in the past 2 years. You know, the civilians were able to push through on some of their priorities. Of course, there were a lot of challenges that they faced, particularly around federal governance, the unions law, etc. But really, I think the events prior to the coup, and then, of course, subsequent to that, really proved that the military never really was in this for the democratic transformation, which is, again, unsurprising for anyone who has been watching Sudan.
Alex Duval, in his televised speech, Mr. Hamdok said that the country is at a dangerous turning point that threatens its whole survival. Do you agree with that sentiment?
I don't think he's exaggerating. I think that there is what we have at the moment is a regime in power that is, in some ways, is a very familiar one. There, in some ways, this is, you know, we're familiar with military dictatorships, but they put on the clothing, the appearance of nationalism, of standing up for saving the nation. But in this case, one of the defining features of this regime is the extent to which it has penetrated the economy and especially rural society. It has militarized much of the commercial sector and increasingly the rural production sector as well, especially through the number two in the regime, General Mohamed Hemeti and his rapid support forces, who are the de facto governing power in Darfur and many of the rural areas. And the depths of this kleptocratic control and the entanglement of this kleptocratic system in the region, with Egypt, with the Gulf states, etc., means that this is actually a different regionalized form of military government that will be harder to uproot. And I think this is really what Abdallah Hamdok, as a conventional economist who had a vision of Sudan resuming a sort of developmental trajectory, is saying. He's saying, I cannot find a way back to the economic and social stabilization of Sudan. We are in the grip of this of this monstrous transboundary military kleptocratic system.
Ahmed El-Jaili, I mean, that is a very dim, grim picture for the future. If in fact, what we have is a situation where the last 2 years of transition, inverted commas, has actually, to full democracy, has actually not been that at all, then how painful is the next weeks and months going to be for this protest movement who are unrelenting in their desire to see a transition to a full democracy?
I think that's the real challenge. We have the full determination of the youth on the street to go on with their protests and regain the freedom that they've yearned for years. And we have the generals who are refusing to give up power. So it's the classic unstoppable force facing the immovable object. But if we read the landscape, we see that Sudan has been ungovernable for the military over the last two months since they've taken over, and the demonstrations have only increased. And I think with the departure of Prime Minister Hamdok, the internal pressure will be coupled by increasing international pressure, and the military won't be able to continue the bloodshed that they have started before for fear of increased international pressure. So they will be faced with a menu of three options. The first is a negotiated exit where they step down and leave the country. And then the second is a possibility of an internal coup within the armed forces. And third is an armed confrontation, some type of civil war. And I think we all prefer the first option, and I think the increased pressure on the military will hopefully yield that outcome. And that's why we urgently hope that the international community will regain its focus on Sudan and try to avert option two and option three that could bring a lot of bloodshed that can be avoided.
Khalid Khair, how do you think the military is going to respond to Abdullah Hamdok's resignation? And do you think that they will follow through on this promise for elections in July 2023, I believe was the date?
I mean, as to the first question, I think they were initially worried about his departure because the reason they brought him back on the 21st of November was so they could gain access to international financing. Obviously, that hasn't materialized because the international community, though it gives overt or tacit approval to the generals, it hasn't backed that up financially, which I think is a good thing. But in the middle of all that sort of negotiation, they have realized that he won't, that the money isn't coming. And now with his resignation, it almost certainly looks like it isn't. So they've been shopping around for a replacement. We've heard certain names, including the former Minister of Finance. But of course, nobody wants to sip from this poison chalice, because any prime minister that is put in place now will, just like Hamdok, be seen to be an accomplice to the murders and the killings and the detentions, etc. And so they're going to have a very difficult time finding a PM. And in any case, they are not the body constitutionally that appoints a prime minister. It is either the FFC or a parliament, which of course has never been formed during this transitionary period. So they will find a very difficult time to make it stick, even if they do find someone who's willing to go in with them. As for the elections, elections in 2023 only benefit the generals. They only benefit the Islamist movement, which is still very much there in the background. And so I think everyone will see through at a sort of early elections, Egypt style, as the sort of theater of democracy rather than the actual genuine commitment to it. And so I don't think they'll get anywhere with early elections in by way of convincing people, both domestically and internationally. It's too soon anyway for many of the political parties to commit to an electoral process only 6 months from now.
Alex Duval, will the international community, do you think, increase its engagement, increase its pressure on the military as a result of this resignation? What can or might it do?
Well, up to now, the international response led by the United States, with Europe in tow over the last few months, has been extremely feeble. The internationals have very, very strong cards in their hands because of the financial dependence of Sudan on debt relief and on multilateral international assistance. But those cards really have not been played at all effectively. What we have seen, particularly from Washington, is that policy in the entire region and the whole of the Horn of Africa has, under the Trump administration, was essentially delegated to Israel, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates. They were given a free hand to do pretty much what they wanted in Sudan, in Ethiopia, and in Somalia. And the Biden administration has not pulled that back. And essentially, the calculation, as I see it, of the generals is that they have their friends in the region. They have Egypt very clearly behind them, Israel through the extension of the Abraham Accords, the recognition of Sudan's recognition of Israel is dealing directly with General Burhan, have no interest in democracy. And the Saudis and the Emiratis, as we know, also have no interest in democracy. And now they are patching up their differences with other states in the region, including Qatar and Turkey, that are also not in favor of democracy. And these states have enormous lobbying power in European capitals and in the US. They had sold arms, et cetera, et cetera. We know that the influence they have. So what Al-Burhan and Hameti are counting on is that they ultimately will see out any pressure for democratization from Western nations because they have this solid backing in the region. And at the moment, Washington, London, Paris, Brussels are doing almost nothing to disabuse them of this preconception.
Ahmed Al-Jaili, do you agree with that assessment in terms of the international allegiances, the geopolitical powers at play here?
Yes and no. I think it's pretty clear that Sudan is in a difficult neighborhood, so to speak. And I think part of the problem is that the pro-democracy camp did a horrible job presenting its case while they were in power. For example, Hamdok happily went on to European capitals and to the US and completely gave up the regional relationships for Burhan and Hemeti to further cement the perception that the pro-democracy camp is a threat to the interests of those regional allies. I think there is a path where the pro-democracy camp can present its case and can present the reality that one, Sudan is ungovernable for these military leaders, and that the long-term stability of Sudan will not happen without the street getting what it wants. And without that, there will be significant ramifications for the region, which will be part of the national security of those regional players. So I think there is an argument to be made to the US, Europe, and definitely including the regional allies, that their long-term interest is actually, even if they don't agree with the concept of democracy, but they have a vested interest in a stable Sudan, and that a democratic Sudan is not going to be an exporter of revolutions, but a place that is stable, that is economically stable, that where they can talk about food security, talk about regional security, and we can have the same conversations. I think other players might be a little different. I think Israel, Russia, and others who may have more nefarious interests might be difficult to win over. But I think at least the Europeans, the Americans, and the regional allies with some constructive dialogue can be brought forward. And I think the possibility of American sanctions on the coup leaders, which is being tabled now in the Congress, might change the equation significantly. Because if those individuals become toxic and become a liability for their regional allies, I think we will see pressure by those regional allies on those individuals to step aside and call for new military leadership that is more willing to heed the calls of the streets.
Khalid Khair, what's your take? What, if any, sort of pressure might make the military backtrack, hand over to a full civilian government now? And if you do think it's possible, would that be internal pressure from the protest movement? Would that be external pressure from the international community, or both?
It does absolutely need to be both. We can certainly bank on the domestic pressure through the pro-democracy movement. What has been not so dependable has been the international pressure. And it's quite clear that for the military, you know, their main constituency is not a domestic one. They all, the different generals, also, however, have different countries that they sort of rely on in a patron-client sort of relationship. And so there is, you know, when we say that the generals are sort of more linked to or more engaged more with the region, that's not necessarily a monolith. You know, there are these sort of individual relationships going on as well. The core problem is, and, you know, to give the Hamdok administration their due, they did realize that the military banked so heavily on the regional players mentioned before. And so they did, you know, try and make sort of overtures to these countries, in particular Saudi Arabia. And we did see some net impact of that in the way that Saudi Arabia, in relation to Egypt, Israel, and the UAE, responded to the coup. But of course, that's meaningless unless it actually translates into pressure, a meaningful pressure, transformative pressure on the generals. And that will only really come about if there is a concerted shift away from Sudan being seen as a security, through a security lens, rather than through a foreign policy lens where genuine partnerships, economic or otherwise, can be cultivated. And so what we have right now is, you know, pressure that is needed essentially from the West on these regional powers that isn't really having the impact. And that's that's due to a global shift in the influence of Western countries, particularly the US, after the disastrous Trump policy of outsourcing regional Horn of Africa policy to the Gulf.
Which is a whole other discussion, a whole other Inside Story program in and of itself. We will have to leave it there for time. A big thank you to all of our guests for joining us on the program, Khalid Khair, Alex Dival, and Ahmed El Jaili. And thank you too for watching. You can see the program again anytime by visiting our website, aljazeera.com. And for further discussion, go to our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/AJInsideStory. You can also join the conversation over on Twitter. Our handle is @AJInsideStory. From me, Kim Vanel, and the whole team here in Doha, bye-bye for now.